This is a People First Radio podcast.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
Award-winning poet Kim Goldberg never thought she would live to see a cure for hepatitis C. But when the cure arrived and Goldberg reaped the victory, it gave her the poem of a lifetime. That poem has now led to her seventh book, Undetectable. Kim documents her hepatitis C journey using a Japanese literary style called haibun, a travel diary paired with haiku.
People First Radio was at Kim Goldberg's launch of Undetectable and will share her comments about hepatitis C, her personal journey to becoming hepatitis C free, and the creative process that resulted in the deeply personal and reflective poetic treasure Kim calls Undetectable.
Here's Kim Goldberg's introduction from the launch of her new book, Undetectable.
As some of you know, this is my seventh book, but in some ways this feels like the most important to me because it documents absolutely what is the most important event in my life and the most important transition and transformation in my life. Many of you know me, and many people know me as a freelance writer, a journalist, a poet, an author. I'm a bird watcher. I have a degree in biology, and so I'm very much a nature lover. I'm out hiking and wandering around a lot. But what virtually nobody has known until really literally 1 month ago, until 4 weeks ago, is that I have also, for the last 45 years, been living with hepatitis C. Now, hepatitis C is a chronic, if it goes into chronic form, is a liver disease. It's a blood-borne viral infection affecting the liver, and people tend to have it for years. If it goes into chronic form, you're going to have it your whole life unless you're cured. And until very recently, there wasn't really a viable cure. About 200, at least a quarter of a million people in Canada have hepatitis C. 3 million is a low estimate for the United States. A more recent revision I saw of that actually put it upwards of 7 million in the United States, people with hepatitis C. Worldwide, it's about 180 million. So it's a huge and quite debilitating situation. It can lead to cirrhosis. It can lead to death. It can lead to liver transplant, certainly. Deaths from hepatitis C now outpace deaths from HIV. And until recently, those of us who had it were just, you know, unless we wanted to go through some very archaic, brutally toxic, prolonged therapies that didn't have a very good cure rate, and so many of us said no to that, we're just going to hang on to our health for as long as we can, there weren't other options. And then all of a sudden, 2 years ago approximately, other options came on stream. Because it's a blood-borne virus, what that means is you actually do need blood-to-blood contact. Infected blood of one person has to actually enter the bloodstream somehow of another person. I almost certainly got it from injection drug use as a teenager. And that, while that is a common mode of transmission, it's by no means the only mode of transmission. So one really important message I want to put out there, and this is the public service announcement at the beginning, don't assume that because you don't have any history of drug use, you don't need to worry about Hep C. Actually, everybody should probably be tested for hepatitis C. Centers for Disease Control is now saying everyone of the baby boom generation, 1945 to 1965 birth year, needs to be tested. And that's because the majority of people who have hepatitis C aren't even aware of it. Even if they've had it for years or decades, they absolutely are not aware. In many cases, people aren't aware until they reach end-stage liver disease. And that's one of the reasons that hepatitis C is referred to as a silent epidemic. It's silent in various ways. It's stigmatized, not discussed much, and so it's silent in that way. But it's also silent, sort of, within your own body. That isn't to say you won't have symptoms in all those years and decades, but you won't imagine that it's related to your liver. So you'll be going to the doctor to be treated for rheumatoid arthritis, to be treated for depression, to be treated for insomnia, to be treated for rashes, to be treated for indigestion, to be treated for type 2 diabetes, to be treated for a whole variety of things, but it's actually hepatitis C.
That's Kim Goldberg providing an introduction at the launch of her new book, Undetectable. The book focuses on her amazing journey to becoming hepatitis C free after qualifying for the clinical trial of a new and highly effective medication, literally a cure for hepatitis C infection. Kim documents her hepatitis C journey using a Japanese literary style called haibun. It's a travel diary paired with haiku poetry. The book is about her personal journey, an inward journey to healing.
You're about to hear Kim Goldberg sharing a series of readings from Undetectable, including haiku poems, reflections, and surprising connections with the lived environments that presented themselves during her journey. Kim also provides important information about hepatitis C, treatment approaches for hepatitis C infection, and shares her own experiences with Havani, the medication that has emerged as a promised cure.
There were nights of hot knifing hash through broken wine bottles. There were double hits of acid on a beach owned by dragons. There were flea bag apartments wallpapered in shag carpet. There were full throttle rides out to China Flats in open convertibles, fishtailing on the ice. There were drugstore heists with tight escapes through air shafts and back alleys. There were hot-wired cars and switched license plates. There was Nazareth, Led Zeppelin, Grand Funk Railroad, blaring on Kmart stereos in crimson bedrooms with red scarves draped over lamps. There were people sleeping in bathtubs and beneath kitchen tables. There were weeks spent in juvie waiting for some piece of shit bologna sandwich on Wonder Bread to be shoved through the slot each day. There were bippy rigs made from cut-down eyedroppers with a baby pacifier on one end and someone's used insulin sharp on the other. It was the age of love beads and sharing and kicking out the jams. We were going to end the war, throw away the rules, get some satisfaction, let Jumping Jack Flash be our anthem. It was 1970. The body as protest, as brick wall, awaiting spray cans. Years later, there was bone-heavy fatigue, nausea, unbearable itching, dizziness, canceled journalism assignments, a brain wrapped in cotton candy, swollen knuckles, stiff knees, days in bed with no food, nights with no sleep, a career disappearing. By February 1995, there was a diagnosis. The body as cloud, settling on a small town. As I mentioned, I was one of the many people with hepatitis C who said, you know what, I'm not going to do that interferon ribavirin combo, which had been about all that was on tap as treatment, as therapy for approximately 20 years. The cure rate was often as low as 40%. It was brutally toxic, a very prolonged treatment. People would often become so sick from the treatment they'd have to stop. They wouldn't be able to finish, even if they did finish. They wouldn't most likely not be cured. They would often lose their thyroids. There's a lot of cases of that. And it just seemed like a pretty bad gamble when my health was actually quite good. What I just read there about the real health decline I had, that was a 3-year period up until I was diagnosed in 1995. My health was just falling apart in all of those ways I just described. And as soon as I was diagnosed and realized it was liver, could go online and just really very quickly, like literally in a matter of a day or two, craft a really solid liver support system for myself with diet, lifestyle changes, things to add, things to remove. And I basically haven't had any overt health problems since then. Although certainly energy management has always been difficult for me because of that. There was not an acceptable treatment, in my opinion. I just decided I'm going to stay as healthy as I can for as long as I can. Initially, that strategy was in place with the thought that I'll stay as healthy as I can for as long as I can until the cure arrives. And then year after year goes by, and there's still, you know, like the real cure, the non-toxic cure that actually works. And nothing was happening. So it's like, okay, I'm just going to stay as healthy as I can for as long as I can. And I, at that point, had the notion, and so many hepatitis C people have too for years and years, I'm just taking it to the grave with me. Either I'll take it to the grave with me or it will take me. That was just a conclusion I came to. And then the cure was invented. Totally different mode of treatment and concept medically from what had been used before. And I was lucky enough, I'll probably get into this later, but the cost of the drugs themselves set by the pharmaceutical companies, the lead company of which is Gilead Sciences in California, is so astronomically high that everywhere, private insurers as well as government-funded plans like we have here in Canada actually cannot afford to cover everybody who has hepatitis C. And so there, even though everybody could be cured right now, the pills are there, 12 weeks of pills, minimal side effect, no more hepatitis C, but it could be years or decades before we actually eliminate hepatitis C because of the slow rate that the drugs are being trickled out due to costs. I myself was not eligible. I myself was not eligible because I wasn't sick enough yet. Yes, I'd had it 45 years, but my liver wasn't damaged enough yet. So, of course, it's, you know, it's just brutal in so many ways to be telling people that your liver has to get more degraded before we'll cure you. But yet that's what's being told. So many people are being told. So I was lucky enough, and the person who helped that happened for me is right here, Sarah. I was lucky enough to get in on a clinical trial. And that's actually the way quite a few people have gotten cured. I found, Sarah put me on the list, a health nurse put me on the list, and for places around BC that do trials, I got a phone call, and I got mine for free through a clinical trial at the Lair Center in Vancouver. Now, I knew that trial was coming up. I knew I was going to be in that trial. And it just happened coincidentally, this wasn't planned, to be reading this book at that time. This is Narrow Road to the Interior, written in the 17th century by Japan's probably most famous and revered poet, Matsuo Basho. Most people know Basho's name in connection to haiku, very short three-line poems. But what he does in this book is a form that he popularized called haibun, in which there's a lot of prose. And what haibun is a combination of, it's very, very often used as a travelogue, doesn't have to be, but it's often used, and certainly by Basho, used as a travel diary. And it combines a short lyrical descriptive prose passage, about this much description of a location, followed by a haiku poem. And then you have your little prose about your next location and a haiku poem, and the story of the journey unfolds as this interplay between prose and poetry, prose and poetry. And I just loved that form and was so enchanted by it that it's not like I went out and deliberately, strategically said, I'm going to do that. It's just I've got to document my journey in that form. Now, Basho's Narrow Road to the Interior refers to a foot journey he took near the end of his life through the very rugged northern interior of Japan, but it also refers to a more esoteric interior, a journey into this kind of an interior of self, in which he came to terms with many things and experienced quite a bit of grief. He took that and three other journeys in that book that are documented in Haibun. He took that in the final decade of his life when he'd lost or given away most of what he owned, his hermit hut, or two of them, I think, had burned down at that point. And it actually is a narrative that really resonates a lot with anybody who's been living with hepatitis C long term. And so I wrote my modern version of my journey, my narrow road to the interior, mapped against the 84 days of treatment. So that was my journey. It was a physical journey as I wandered the streets and forests and rocky beaches of Nanaimo each day, and wandered also in the process inevitably into Nanaimo's history. But it's also a very much an inner journey into questions of healing. What constitutes illness? What constitutes wellness? Is the elimination of virus equivalent to being healed? Is that the end result, or is that only the very first step on a healing journey? Very at dawn. In 3 hours, I will be at the Lehr Center in Vancouver, taking my first pills. The thick buzz of 200 students fills the departure terminal. They are headed to a science show at the P&E Fairgrounds. The gate opens. I race up the stairs and long walkway. This is the only time in 40 years of ferry riding that I'm the first to board the ship. I tell myself it's to beat the crush of students to the cafeteria. But I take a seat in the bow instead and watch the cormorants atop creosoted pilings, drying their prehistoric wings in the day's first light. Nanaimo grows small. What I thought was the bow is really the stern. My whole world was upside down at that point, front to back and back to front. Day 4. Everything strives to replicate itself, to sign its name upon the landscape, to emboss the planet with its unique molecular script of adenine, thymine, cytosine, guanine base pairs, or their analogs, the puffball with its burst hull, the dandelions gone to seed in my garden, me writing this book. For this is immortality. It will not be surrendered without a fight. A tree frog's booming love song pours from the downspout. The new drugs work really fast. It's like, it's so fast it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable almost to medical science, and it's certainly unbelievable to those of us with bodies that have been occupied by hepatitis C for decades. I had it for about 45 years at that point. And brain fog, varying degrees of cognitive impairment, brain fog, just kind of muzzy-headedness, and energy loss were the two most kind of significant things I lived with all the time. And I had ways to beat them back, but I was also always sort of aware that they were there. So day 7, just 1 week in, 1 week is all I've been on it. Hello, brain. After years of drifting in fog, unable to chart a course, hail fellow mariners, or even know for certain which ocean it is floating upon, my brain has miraculously returned to home port. It can hold all the pieces of a story once again, follow a narrative, know which strands of the orb web are sticky and which are safe. I no longer need to externalize my existence onto post-it notes. I don't know why I am crying. Sunny hilltop, a dogwood grows from the granite.
That was award-winning author Kim Goldberg reading from her new book, Undetectable, and speaking about her experiences as she embarked upon a treatment in a drug trial to cure hepatitis C infection. Kim presented at the Vancouver Island Regional Library's Harbourfront branch in downtown Nanaimo.
Kim Goldberg's new book, Undetectable, documents her hepatitis C journey using a Japanese literary style called haibun, a travel diary paired with haiku poetry. The book is about her personal journey, an inward journey, to healing. But along the way, Kim began to discover a range of undetectability in the wild and built environments where she lived.
Here's Kim Goldberg.
The title of the book is Undetectable. I was reading Narrow Road to the Interior when I decided and knew that I was about to start this clinical trial and knew I'm going to document my story, my journey, my 84 days of treatment using that form. And that is my template. Right away, before I'd written a word, this title, Undetectable, came to me. And titles, when you're an author and you're working on a long-term book project, The title, even if it's only your working title, it's very important. It's actually very much functions as a beacon, because particularly when you're, you know, in that first draft stage, you don't really know, does it fit or not? Is this on the spine or off the spine? You know, you haven't quite found your rhythm, your tone, where you're really going with this work. The title, even if it's just a working title, is the thing that keeps focusing you, keeps centering you, keeps answering those questions for you. So Undetectable just locked itself down, and I could not shake it. It was frightening to me, because I couldn't quite figure out, well, why does it have to be undetectable? And so I, more than once in my writing process, over the weeks and the months that I was working on this, I would generate just longhand on notebook paper two full pages of alternate possible titles, thinking, won't this work? What's wrong with this? This could be kind of interesting, like in a sort of rational, cerebral, clever, literary, double entendre sort of way. And no, only undetectable would work. But it hadn't revealed itself to me as to why. And then, remember, I'm walking around every day and the words are coming to me, a whole lot of different entries on things that were undetectable just started coming forth. I wasn't reaching for them. I wasn't saying, let's look for things undetectable. And one of the first was this: undetectable. The shouts of little brown bats pinging their winged prey along the Millstone River at dusk. Chiropterologists divide bats into shouters and whisperers. Little brown bats, Myotis lucifugus, meaning mouse ears fleeing light, are shouters. Their echolocation cries are actually as loud as smoke alarms, but beyond the range of human hearing. I see their shadow bodies dart and flutter above me, but all I hear is the scuff of my shoes on old leaves, the rasp of a towhee not yet asleep, a final gust through the fir trees. The dark reorganizes itself into a door. Undetectable. The identities of the 53 Chinese mine workers who died in the blast at Nanaimo's number one coal mine on May 3, 1887. This was the largest man-made explosion in the world until the Halifax explosion of 1917. The mine burned for one full day. There's a memorial plaque at the mine entrance on the corner of Milton and Esplanade. It lists the Chinese fatalities as Chinese miners, 3, 71, 72, 77, 83, and so on, up to Chinese miner 145. For this was the only way these men were listed in the company records, by tag number. Employers were not legally required to report deaths of Chinese employees in British Columbia until 1897. The 97 white co-workers, who also died that way, are listed on the plaque by first and last name. A sparrow sings from a thicket, revealing without revealing. Undetectable. The walls, beds, restraints, experiments at the Nanaimo Indian Hospital. This is where it stood, this weedy scruff of land along Fifth Street, across from what is now Vancouver Island University. Writing a book, another kind of purging. The 200-bed hospital operated from 1946 to 1967, funded by the United Church of Canada and the Federal Department of Health. Numerous unexplained surgeries were performed on hundreds of First Nations children from all over Vancouver Island. The children were taken from their families and brought to the hospital, ostensibly to be treated for tuberculosis. They remained for years. Adult survivors claim they never had tuberculosis. Some of them later discovered they were missing bones or a kidney, or could not have children. row of ducklings pulled beneath the lake, one by one. They were tied into their beds at night. Some were immobilized in a full body restraint for months until they lost the use of their legs. Some were given injections daily that made them sick. Survivors say many small corpses are buried on this land. They say they witness staff hauling out little bodies on that metal gurney practically every morning. There is no record of these deaths and burials, no suggestion that tuberculosis was the cause. In 2004, the Nanaimo Indian Hospital was bulldozed. Two owls on one branch, the weight of their silence. I'm standing outside the cyclone fence topped with razor wire, gazing at the broken asphalt where the hospital once loomed. It is overgrown now with thickets of blackberry and scotch broom, alder and Douglas fir. Bright yellow dandelions are scattered around the fringe like a thousand suns. I hear a rattling groan overhead, a primitive sound from earlier epochs. I look up and see the silhouette of a great blue heron glide past on its way to the lakes at Colliery Dam. The planet is reclaiming its body inch by inch, devouring memory as it advances, erasing penetration. Or is it synthesizing the past, incorporating it into xylem, phloem, cambium, leaf axils? Chain-link fence, holding back the wildness, a junco in each diamond. I actually started to get scared at some point because I kept writing, kept finding these undetectable things coming forward that I wanted to write entries about, but yet what they all were things that while undetectable actually were there or had been there. And so I began, you see, when you have hepatitis C and you're on treatment, the word you're waiting for is undetected. That's the holy grail, because with the way the new drugs work, undetected is actually, you know, after a certain period of time of undetected, is a true cure. It's not a remission. It's not that the virus has been shoved down to a low level. It's actually gone. There isn't any virus remaining in the body. And so that's what we're all waiting to hear. It's the magic. It's the transformation has occurred. But yet every undetectable example that I was coming forward with from my environment wasn't of things that weren't there. It was of things that couldn't be perceived, that through our cultural illiteracy we never knew or had forgotten about, or through the limitations of our bodies. We can't hear the echolocation shouts of the bats, even though they're as loud as smoke alarms. I found that rather interesting. But then I realized, and so I thought, does that mean when I reach undetectable on my viral load test, 12 weeks post-treatment, which is the goal we're all aiming for, that it won't be a true undetected? Is that what this creative process is offering up to me? But no, I realized what it actually meant is that even though the virus will be eradicated, and I could tell that was happening, its effect on my life will always be there. I mean, everything I am today, every aspect of my life has been influenced by this. The fact that I'm single, the fact that I'm child-free, the fact that I'm self-employed. It's all of my choices throughout my whole life have to do with this in some way or another.
Kim Goldberg's new book, Undetectable, documents her hepatitis C journey using a Japanese literary style called haibun, a travel diary paired with haiku poetry. The book is about her personal journey and inward journey to healing.
Kim read from Undetectable and spoke about her experiences as she embarked upon treatment in a drug trial to cure hepatitis C infection. She presented at the Vancouver Island Regional Library's Harborfront Branch in downtown Nanaimo. People First Radio was there, and we're sharing audio from that book launch on today's program. Here's more from Kim Goldberg.
Alala illa li.
Looking back, I see that my solitary path commenced after I returned from Morocco in 1981. A palm reader in Tangier told me I would have a long and serious illness ahead. 14 years later, I was diagnosed with hepatitis C. It had quietly been replicating in my body long before the prophecy in the Kasbah. I have never made the connection until this moment. In online forums, Hep C patients refer to themselves as hepers, a phonetic stone's throw from lepers. The silence of a gull with a star in its mouth. Regardless, isolationism has become the path I walk and the path that walks me. Its purity and my ecstasy are increased by this new knowing. Low tide, all the poems lie exposed. For 3/4 of my life, I have coexisted with an entity, a companion, an alter intelligence, a shotgun wedding between virus and teenage flesh, sanctified in the condemned annex of a North Bend hotel, or a Coos Bay fire trap with a Colt 45 on the table, or a shack in Eastside where the toilet sewer pipe emptied onto the dirt, or a dilapidated party house in Coquille, or quite a few other possible venues. Who will I be without it? Fir limbs strewn across the road. All night, I heard the wind. And in fact, that became a huge issue for me as I was on treatment and hadn't really thought about it before. I mean, you'd think, well, who doesn't want to get a virus out of their body? Who doesn't want to be cured of a chronic, debilitating, potentially fatal illness that's, slowly kind of demolishing the liver? But yet it was so woven in. I don't really know an existence without hepatitis C. I actually literally don't know either who I would have been or who I will now go on to be. I have some haiku in here somewhere, what happens to a tapestry when you remove the weft? So it's actually a lot more complex. The whole emotional process and self-identity process is surprisingly complex. It's not that I didn't want to get rid of it, but it's that there was also a frightening aspect to removing a part of yourself, no matter how noxious, that actually has always been part of you and that is somehow linked to who you are and the person you've become. Two times in the last 2 days, I have steeped a cup of tea containing nothing but hot water in an empty tea ball. A third time, the tea ball contained a teaspoon of rolled oats. Has the much-trumpeted return of my brain been overrated? Unstable timeline. All the birds become bullets, become shooting stars. So that was day 41, about the midway point. I got to say, the ribavirin was really kicking in at this point and kind of taken me off the rails a bit in various ways. So I was on 2 drugs in my clinical trial, Harvoni, which is the real miracle drug, and as far as I can tell from my research, currently the most expensive pill in the world, wholesaling for $1,125 per pill U.S., and you need 84 pills. So a course of treatment at the wholesale price is $94,500. Consequently, individuals can't really do this on their own. And insurance companies, as well as government-funded healthcare plans like we have here in Canada, do get discounted rates, and perhaps even substantial discounts, but still, it's extremely expensive. and they can't treat everybody at once. And then the other drug I was on was one of the bad old drugs, ribavirin, and that was just the way this clinical trial was set up and was also related to the particular genotype I had. The numerical drug Harvoni actually wouldn't likely have cured me on its own. So I had one of the bad old drugs, ribavirin, thrown in with it. Ribavirin induces hemolytic anemia and psychotic rages and a, you know, variety of things. And so my brain, Harvoni, the miracle drug, has a very, doesn't have hardly any side effects for most people, but the one side effect it does have for quite a few of us is this thing that's become colloquially known as the Harvoni high. You get a really good buzz, you're euphoric, you're on top of the world. It's like, wow, even once I'm cured, could I please take Harvoni forever? You know, but then as the time goes on and you're getting more and more anemic from the ribavirin and, you know, and just flying into wild rages at, you know, a telephone or something, at anything, then the brain, the great gains that the brain has made are starting to fall apart. But that's all temporary, you know. It's just the ribavirin, the downside of the ribavirin is just lasts as long as you're taking it. And I knew that going into it, so I thought, tough it out. The miracle cure has only been available on the market for a little bit over 2 years. And then 1 year later, the drug that cured me, Harvoni, also developed by Gilead, also hit the market. In the U.S. and Canada, Sovaldi wholesales for $1,000 per pill and Harvoni for $1,125. In most cases, 84 pills are needed. Under certain circumstances, 24 weeks of pills are required. Consequently, insurers, both private and government, say they cannot afford to cure everyone who has hepatitis C. Within the drumming of a woodpecker, more drumming. It would appear there is indeed no balm in Gilead, at least not for a great many who are in need of it. In ancient times, at the height of the balm trade in the Middle East, the balm of Gilead was said to be worth twice its weight in silver. Today, Gilead Sciences' Sovaldi is worth more than 67 times its weight in gold. Park bench, small offering of coins. 3 days later, still there. It is mercifully cool and overcast when I awake this morning, and strangely rosy. The sky is a welcome relief from the unrelenting weeks of searing heat and brightness and high winds, until I realize it is not. Vancouver Island is shrouded in a yellow-orange haze from myriad wildfires burning so far away we don't yet smell the smoke, so infinite they color our day, so penetrating they show us the future. Undetectable, each spider web, until the ash fall. It is not just virions and poems I am shedding along this narrow trail. I watch them drop from me daily and roll down the embankment where they become lodged in the nests of pigeon guillemots. Guillemots build their nests on vertical cliff faces, or the rocky shore below, or even in old bomb casings from bygone massacres. I am shedding people also, or rather the energy fields that surround certain people. The people just happen to be attached. Some would say this human shedding is a result of the ribavirin side effect, in which the patient experiences adverse emotional and psychological states that place stress on relationships during treatment. But that's not it at all. This is a time for offloading all toxins. I want no dead weight, no negative drag on this journey. Bending each wing, tilting, correcting to fly between the trees.
Kim Goldberg is an award-winning poet and author living in Nanaimo on Vancouver Island. In her seventh book, Undetectable, Kim documents her hepatitis C journey using a Japanese literary style called haibun, a travel diary paired with haiku.
We've been sharing audio from the launch of Undetectable, held at the Vancouver Island Library's Harborfront Branch in Nanaimo. Kim Goldberg shared a sampling of haiku and written reflections from the book and spoke candidly about her journey to a cure from hepatitis C infection. You can find out more about Undetectable and purchase copies from Kim Goldberg's website at pigsquash.wordpress.com.
We want to acknowledge the music used in the production of this segment. You heard Led Zeppelin's Good Times, Bad Times from their 1969 album Led Zeppelin, Grand Funk Railroad's Nothing Is the Same from their album Closer to Home, and Karim Azadiah's Heart of a Woman from the album Morocco Southern Music.
We also shared music created by Canadian multi-instrumentalist David Finkel. You heard Native Flute on West Coast and Many Minds. You can find those songs on YouTube.
People First Radio is an initiative of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society in partnership with Radio Malaspina Society and broadcast on CHLY 101.7, radio from Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the partnering organizations. Listen to People First Radio on demand. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpages.